At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Welcome, everybody, to Redacted on this Wednesday. I'm Clayton Morris.
I'm Natalie Morris.
And on this show, we tend to cover the stories the mainstream media largely ignores. One of the big stories the mainstream media has been ignoring for about a year now is the fact that Russia, well, under sanctions, is actually, well, the exact opposite of what the mainstream media is telling us. We're going to go there to talk about what is under, like, what life is like under sanctions right now in Russia. Also, the latest on the war and what this spring offensive may or may not look like. We'll talk about that.
Plus, this week, something amazing happened. Free speech at Oxford. We're going to bring you the speech, or at least pieces of it, that Oxford whiny babies really wanted to prevent and were not successful. What do you know? Free speech reigns out sometimes.
Sometimes, but then I'm going to rain on your parade a little bit because a friend of the show, Kit Clarenberg, who is a journalist and writes at the Gray Zone on a regular basis, had been detained at the UK airport in London and for 5 hours interrogated by police. Unbelievable story. Kit Clarenberg is going to join us to talk about what happened when he was detained by police just for being a journalist and breaking big stories. All of that and more as Redacted starts right now.
Well, guess what else? You guys, we have a special guest we did not mention off the top of the show is Tom Wheelwright. I mentioned the Wealthability podcast a lot on this show because I like it so much. Tom is usually the only one I really trust for financial education. And if you like financial education, like we both do, you're really going to appreciate his take on the debt ceiling. And that also is later in the show.
Yeah, Tom is one of the smartest people that we know and the smartest, perhaps the smartest tax accountant in the United States. Really, really smart. So we're going to talk about, the debt ceiling, among other things. But we do have a daily newsletter as well we'd love to tell you about. And it's totally free. And it is really the coolest newsletter on the block. In fact, all of the kids are talking about it. Like if you go to a high school and you're in the cafeteria during lunch, like the girls aren't talking about the boys. The boys aren't talking about the girls. You know what they're all talking about? Is the Redacted newsletter. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, it's the coolest.
It's sweeping the nation. It's unbelievable. But it is really the greatest newsletter to kick off your morning. And it would give you about four or five big stories of the day. And you can read it in about 5 or 10 minutes over your cup of coffee in the morning with your feet up, with your dog in your lap or whatever. And there, we start off with a little like, hey, in case you missed it, some little fun nuggets at the top of the, at the top of the newsletter. And then we get into some of the market news and a couple of the big stories. Anyway, it's totally free, but it's our way to stay connected with you because God knows these platforms love to censor us on a regular basis and ban us and block us. And the only way for us to stay connected with you is through our free newsletter. So go and sign up right now. Redacted.inc is the website, not .com, it's .inc. Put in your email address and then you need to verify the email. We send you a welcome email. And then tomorrow morning at about 6:30 or 7 a.m. Eastern time, you'll get Thursday's newsletter. So join what all the cool kids are talking about. Redacted.inc is the place to go. Well, a swarm of drone strikes has hit Moscow and the largest attack on the city since the beginning of this war. Putin has responded with strikes in the heart of Ukraine's intelligence service, and Ukraine is trying to fast track its membership into NATO. Are we at a turning point in this war? Where are we right now? Let's ask former UN weapons inspector and former U.S. Marine Scott Ritter. Scott is back on the show. Great to see you, Scott. You just returned from Russia, and I just got to ask you, I mean, I was following your travels there on social media a little bit for a month. You know, everyone says, well, you know, Russia is being destroyed with sanctions. It's a shell of it of its former self. I'm sure the grocery stores are empty. People are starving. Putin is dying of cancer. What is the truth? What did you see when you were in Russia?
Well, I can't address any issues pertaining to Vladimir Putin's health. I didn't meet right. him, so I don't right. know a lot.
He's got kidney failure. He's got there's a long list of things that apparently that you know the West loves to say that he's dying of. So but, yeah,
you know, for a dying man, I would tell you his presence in Russia is very vigorous and vibrant. He travels a lot. He speaks a lot. He's a visible leader. So if this is what a dying man looks like, then I think Russians will want him to keep dying for a long time because he's alive and well and living and leading. And that's the important thing. He's leading. And the Russians recognize him as their leader. We speak of the war and the military aspects of this conflict, and I guess we'll touch on that in a second. But, you know, Clausewitz, Sun Tzu, and other famous military philosophers have all said something similar along the lines of war is an extension of politics by other means. And this war was never supposed to. This war, first of all, was provoked by the West. I think everybody needs to understand that. This was not a war that Russia wanted. Russia was provoked into this war. It's a provocation that's been going on since 1992. In 2008, the exact consequences of trying to invite NATO or Ukraine into NATO were set forth in writing by William Burns. He's the current CIA director, former U.S. ambassador. And he said straight up, if you invite Ukraine into NATO, you will set in motion events that will lead to a Russian military intervention. He wrote that in early 2008. In November 2008, Ukraine was invited. So the West has been provoking this military intervention for some time now. But the idea was that the military intervention would trigger sanctions that would destroy Russia. You see, it wasn't that the West was going to defeat Russia militarily or that Ukraine was going to defeat Russia. The idea was to hold Russia militarily until the economy collapsed and then create a sort of Moscow Maidan movement to replicating the 2014 coup d'etat that evicted Viktor Yanukovych. That was the goal. That was the objective. Newsflash, it has failed miserably. I arrived in Novosibirsk, the third largest city in Russia, the largest growing economy in Russia. There is so much investment taking place right now, foreign investment, internal investment. I don't think the people who planned the sanction campaign understand the reality of Russian economy. By sanctioning, for instance, the Russian oligarchs, and taking their money from them. One, it was one of the most welcome moves by the Russian people. They applauded the West for doing that because for decades, the Russian people and the Russian government had been angered by the flight of Russian capital out of Russia by these oligarchs who steal money from the Russians and then take it abroad. So the Russians applauded this. But by locking the Russian oligarch class out of Western investment possibilities, there are now literally a trillion dollars plus of capital waiting to be invested. And these people have no choice but to invest it in Russia.
Wow.
And so they are pouring money into Russia. You know, a year ago during the pandemic, in the post-pandemic environment, The planners for Russian urban areas were looking for capital. They didn't have enough money. I mean, they were building, but there were so many projects to do, so they had to allocate their resources carefully. They're in a situation now where they don't know how to spend the money. There is so much money available right now that they are literally funding projects that otherwise would not have been funded. You can't go anywhere in a major urban environment in Russia without seeing cranes taking place, buildings going up, and these buildings are already allocated in terms of the workspace. Companies are flooding into Russia from around the world. Newsflash, America and the Europe. You ain't the only players in town. In fact, you're nobody compared to the rest of the world. The rest of the world, the global South, India, Pakistan, Iran, China, are coming into Russia investing. There has been no pause whatsoever. Russia is accelerating right now. Russia is the healthiest it has been ever, ever. In its entire history, Russia has never been this healthy economically. You know, when I go around the United States, there's these little joke stickers, you know, because Joe Biden, of course, is infamously, you know, called everything that's happened wrong in America Putin's tax. Putin did this, Putin did that, Putin did that. And yet people mocked it because they, you know, you get to the gas station, you have high Oprah, and there's these little stickers with Joe Biden saying, I did this, you know, pointing at it.
Right.
I have to tell you that the standing joke right now in Russia is, thank you, Joe Biden.
Wow.
Thank you, Joe Biden, because they are literally looking at it saying, do you not understand what you have done? You have made this economy, this Russian economy, so vibrant, so vigorous. Is it perfect? No, it's not a utopia. You know, the Western media will always be able to go out and find little chinks in the armor and say, aha, what about this? What about that? What about this? Guys, you're missing the big picture. The big picture is Russia is alive, well, living, thriving, thriving, thriving. There are no empty shelves in Russia. No empty shelves in Russia. Prices in Russia are ridiculously low. You know, when people say, you know, Russia's GDP matches that of, you know, Italy or whatever. Guys, you're missing the point. Purchasing power. The ruble is... Because prices are so low and inflation so low, you get more bang with the ruble than you do with the buck. And so even though on paper it may not look like the Russians make as much money, what they're able to do with their money in terms of spending and quality of life is amazing. And then the other thing I will say is this. If you thought you were going to break the spirit of the Russian people, think again. You know, one of the greatest gifts, the second greatest gift that the West gave was creating the condition where Vladimir Putin was compelled to partially mobilize, you know, the 300,000 people that he mobilized back in September. Set up panic through the non-believers. When I say non-believers, I mean the people that didn't support Putin, the Navalny supporters. Around 300,000, 400,000 of them fled Russia, much to the glee of the West. You know what Russia did? They opened the doors and said, go. And you literally got rid of all the empty baggage. All of the dead weight in Russian society is gone. And the Russians are ecstatic because they don't have to deal with these people who hate Putin, who hate Russia from their perspective. You ran away from your country when your country needed you. There are many people that I worked with in Russia during this trip who are not Putin supporters. I will tell you that straight up. They support Russia and Putin as the leader, so they're not going to turn their back on him, but they have questions. They have a lot of questions, and at some point in time, Putin will be called upon to answer these questions. But when Russia needed them, they are there, they stayed, they are loyal, they are patriotic, and that is the nation right now. They're not a bunch of chest-thumping USA, USA fake American patriots, you know, sunshine soldiers who are patriotic, but they don't do anything. These are Russians who are stoic, and they are there. They are working. This is not a defeated nation. This is a nation that's in it for the long haul. And they have a vision that's far greater than anything anybody in the West has been able to articulate about what their vision towards Russia is. Russia is thinking beyond Ukraine. Ukraine is a big topic. Russia's working that issue. It's frustrating for many Russians that it's taken this long to solve the issue. But the Russians are also looking beyond Ukraine. They're looking towards a world where Russia is part of a multipolar community that the United States no longer directs. The United States is invited to the table, but the day and age of America telling people what to do is over, finished, and that's clear in Russia today.
Yeah, it's clear, of course, with the 30 new additional countries that want to join the BRICS nations as well. you know, it's sunsetting on the U.S. dollar, as we've been covering here on this show. You were there then in Russia when that drone strike hit the Kremlin, hit the Capitol. Yep. At the time, of course, Zelensky came out, gave a speech, said we had nothing to do with that. The United States now says they did. Of course, we've been saying before that they don't do anything without NATO's supervision or involvement in any of this. So it was all a joke to begin with. And then overnight or the past 48 hours, we've seen a swarm of drones hitting Moscow. They say, of course, that those the defense of Russian Ministry of Defense says they were all taken care of. A few of them hit residential buildings, though. So when you were there among the people and hearing their response, were they stunned that, oh my gosh, now Moscow is now under attack?
No. Look, the Russians know that they're at war. That strike on the Kremlin took place, I believe, on May 3rd, in the lead up to Victory Day. And let me just give you another thing. In America and in Europe, they sell Victory Day, May 9th, as some sort of Putin-generated propaganda exercise, where Red Square is filled with the loyalists and there's a lot of made-for-TV moments. Hey, ladies and gentlemen watching this show, Victory Day is real. It's a real Russian holiday. And it's a Russian holiday that resonates with every single Russian because 27 million Soviets died during World War II at the hands of Nazi Germany. There's not a family in Russia that didn't suffer the harshest possible consequences of that conflict. They look up, they look to the sky because they know in their hearts that their grandparents, their parents, their relatives are looking down on them, holding them to account for what they do in honor of the sacrifice that was made. This is part of the Russian soul. And that's the other thing I learned on this trip is, you know, in the West, we mock the Russian soul. We hear people say that. We dismiss it. It's real. It resonates. It defines Russia. It is who the Russian people are. So anybody who thought that you could launch a drone strike on Moscow on May 3rd and somehow panic the Russians into doing something, you know, on May 9th, the actual day of the parade, Moscow was struck, I believe, by 9 to 12 drones. You didn't hear about it, but it was there. The drone attack came in. The Russians shot down most of them. It's an issue. Are the Russians frustrated by this? Yes. Would they like perfect air defense? Yes. But these drones are slow. They're low flying. They're hard to detect. And they're just a mosquito bite. It's a propaganda exercise. But the Russians aren't losing sight. This is a nation that is committed to victory, not victory just in Ukraine, but victory against the collective West. And a handful of drone strikes are not going to change any aspect of that. What it has done is liberated the Russian leadership to start taking out what they call decision-making centers. And ask the Ukrainians how that feels. They just lost their military intelligence headquarters. They lost it. It's gone. Everybody in that building is dead. They will lose other decision-making centers as this, if these these strikes continue to escalate.
Do we know if NATO, this is, of course, we heard reports months ago of major attacks after the last round of these style attacks where Putin launched on these decision-making centers, a bunker outside of Kiev, specifically being hit with NATO decision-makers in there. Do we know, are these just Ukrainians? Are they NATO as well? U.S. intelligence that we won't hear about that are also hitting these attacks? Anything you know about that?
Well, I think the number that was put out on the previous one, which I think took place near Lvov in western Ukraine, was 200 to 300. Now, that's just a ridiculously high number. If you take a look at the documents that were leaked by this airman in Massachusetts, the documents acknowledge that there are boots on the ground. Over, I think, 100 Americans are on the ground. Most of them rotate in and out of Ukraine. Many of them work out of the embassy. Is it possible that Americans or NATO designated personnel are in these bunkers? Yes, that is a possibility. But to put 200 to 300 is ridiculous. One, in this day and age of connectivity, real-time connectivity, you don't need to go through that risk. You can keep these people in Poland and maintain the connectivity with the Ukrainians without putting these people at risk. So while I do believe that there have been casualties and there are some credible reports coming out about casualties, I think the casualties that are taking place are on personnel that are providing critical logistics support. You know, billions of dollars of military equipment has been provided to the Ukrainians. This is a logistical nightmare, a maintenance nightmare, and an accounting nightmare. And so I think you have NATO resources pushed forward to support this logistical effort, not planning for the battle that's taking place outside of Ukraine. But there have to be people on the ground to assist Ukraine in dealing with the basically the mountain of logistical support requirements that have been accrued because of this. And I think these are the people that have suffered casualties. And I do believe that there have been dead, and I do believe there have been wounded on the part of active duty NATO personnel. Whether or not this includes Americans, I can't say.
Victoria Nuland last week admitted that for the past 4 to 5 months, the United States has been actively involved in the planning process of this counteroffensive. Despite New York Times reports, despite Politico reports that say they're frustrated because Ukraine just won't share any information about their spring offensive, their summer offensive, which we found laughable here on this show. And Victoria Nuland then confirmed that the United States, NATO, has been actively involved in this spring offensive planning for 4 to 5 months. She said this publicly. So where are we with this offensive? What do you think we're going to see as we see these little pinprick mosquito bite attacks and drone strike attacks right now? The pressure, of course, is on for this somehow counteroffensive. What do you think we're going to see?
Well, we know that the forces that were allocated for this offensive, and we know this not just from the leaked documents, but just because of public statements, 9 to 12 brigades worth of Ukrainian forces have been equipped and trained by NATO and their European non-NATO European allies since the fall of last year. And that these brigades are, by and large, ready on paper. But as I mentioned to you, these brigades have incorporated a sustainability nightmare. You have different kinds of tanks, different kinds of armored fighting vehicles, different kinds of artillery, all of which have their own logistical tails. Each one is different. I will tell you this: if the United States tried to carry out an offensive operation using 12 brigades that were organized in this fashion with differing equipment and support, we couldn't do it. And we're the best army in the world. We couldn't do it. Now, we expect the Ukrainians somehow to be able to do this with troops that are not properly trained. They're not properly led. They're not properly motivated. We have taken them. It took me 2.5 years as a Marine working with the best people in the world, U.S. Marines, to master the art of combined arms maneuver warfare through nonstop live fire training in 29 Palms, California in the 1980s. And I will tell you that if we had ceased training for any period of time, 2 to 6 months, our effectiveness would have plummeted. You have to constantly train to maintain this skill set. We've taken select Ukrainian forces and run them through a very shortened, abbreviated training course in Germany on combined arms combat. It's a joke, literally a joke. No American soldier could go through that training and be considered combat capable. And yet we've taken the Ukrainians, we've married them up with this disparate set of equipment, and we're saying you must now carry out a counteroffensive against an army that defines itself by the defense, and that's Russia, the Russian army, the best defensive army in the world. And so if everything was going Ukraine's way, this counteroffensive would have no chance of ever succeeding. But everything's not going their way. The Russians have, over the course of the year, mastered their intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance capabilities, their satellites, their aircraft, their electronic warfare. They are tracking this material, and they are taking it out. All of the logistics support, the fuel, the ammunition, everything, spare parts that gets accumulated in warehouses, these warehouses are being taken out. The Ukrainians have zero capacity to carry out any meaningful counteroffensive, and it's been hampered even more by the battle for Bakhmut. The Russians killed 75,000 Ukrainians in this battle. I just want to make that number out there again so people understand what the heck just happened. 75,000 Ukrainian soldiers were killed. 60,000 of these soldiers represents the size of the Ukrainian counteroffensive force. So the 60,000 troops that NATO trained for this counteroffensive are no longer available for the counteroffensive because 75,000 Ukrainians died in the Bakhmut area. These troops now have to fill that gap. There are no troops available for a meaningful counteroffensive. And if the Ukrainians attempt to do something to pull forces out, to cobble together some sort of desperate attack, it won't even be Battle of the Bulge like, because they won't get the penetration of the Russian lines. They'll be slaughtered before they get there, and then there's nothing left. And this is what the Ukrainian generals are trying to tell Zelensky right now, is stop playing politics with the lives of Ukrainian soldiers. You already did that in Bakhmut. We told you not to commit to this battle. 75,000 soldiers are dead. That's dead. That means about 150,000 are wounded. That's a lot of guys that are no longer available to be on the front lines fighting. Jeez. The Ukrainians are having trouble getting manpower. They're scooping old men. They're recruiting 16 and 17-year-olds. They're running around hijacking people off the streets. What do you think the motivation factor is of a man who thought he was going home to his family, getting hit, put in a car, thrown in 4 days later with no training, told you're going in the front line? You think he's ready to give his life for his country? He's going to, but he's not going to be able to give it in the way that the Ukrainians would like, with, you know, zeal and aggressiveness and going forward. He's going to give it cowering in a trench, saying, what the hell am I doing here? I don't know how to use this weapon. And the Russian artillery is raining down on me. The Ukrainians have no artillery ammunition left. Their air defense system is being destroyed as we speak. Two of the three Patriot systems that have been provided are gone, off the table, not there anymore. Jeez. That's happening to the totality of the Ukrainian air defense. This war is all but over. There's a lot of fighting left to be done. But anybody who's waiting for a magical Ukrainian counteroffensive to suddenly turn the table, just like sanctions, it ain't working, guys. Russia has won this. You know, we hear a lot of talk, you know, the Ukrainians, you know, they got new tanks. They didn't get any new tanks. The Challenger tanks provided by the British are old. The Leopard tanks provided by the Germans are old. You know what? The Russians right now are producing 100 advanced T-90 tanks a month. Wow. 100 a month. So while we're sitting here giving the Ukraine, we're scraping the barrel to give Ukrainians things. For F-16 fighters, 40-year-old aircraft. They're not new. They're not good. They're junk. And the aircraft the Ukrainians are going to get are all airplanes that have lost their operational expiration date. The Dutch were pretty much honest about it. They said, oh, we'll give you F-16s, but only after we can't use them anymore because they've passed their use-by date. Right. Then we'll give them to you. So this is the Ukrainian military with all these so-called magic weapons, none of which work. The Russians, you know, everybody's saying, oh, they ran out of everything. They're not running out of anything. Their defense industry is mobilized. It's working. It's punching out stuff. They will never run out of missiles. They will never run out of artillery. They will never run out of tanks because, A, the Ukrainians aren't killing that many of them, and, B, they're just building more and more and more. It's not just for Ukraine. People forget that Putin signed an order expanding the total Russian army to 1.5 million people. Finland, that just joined NATO? Yeah, that's right, Finland. You got a 70,000-man Russian army corps being formed right now north of St. Petersburg. Fresh troops, fresh equipment, all because of you, Finland, because you decided to join NATO. They're going to be matched by another 30,000 up in the Kola Peninsula. That's 100,000 troops, Russian troops, that didn't exist before. They exist now, and they're equipped with the best equipment in the world. And that goes for the totality of the Russian perimeter. This war has made Russians stronger, made Russia stronger militarily, economically, and most importantly, domestically, politically. I've never seen the Russian people so unified over being Russian than I saw them today.
And these leaders in the West continue to play politics with these people's lives, and these poor people continue to be killed. And now you're pulling young men out of colleges and off the streets in order to, you know, in conscription and throwing them into the meat grinder. Unbelievable, unbelievable. And I guess thanks, Joe Biden, and put that sticker right there for making Russia right the strongest it's ever been. Scott Ritter, thank you so much. Thank you for sharing your insights and what you saw on this month-long trip to Russia. Really, really fascinating. Eye-opening, I hope, for a lot of our audience who really have no idea what's going on inside of Russia. Scott, thank you so much for your insights on this.
Thanks for having me.
And it's just, thank you, Scott. It's just a story we don't see. I mean, it's in the West. We don't see this. We don't see the coverage at all because the mainstream media ignores what's actually happening.
I mean, a lot of times you do see in the Financial Times that, oh, you know, Russia has a really low interest rate right now. Russia has a low unemployment rate. They have, you know, record GDPs, with a caveat that it's just for now because sanctions are really going to start to take that away. Oh, sorry. What?
Yeah, I was just saying.
There's always like this, don't take this seriously couching of the way the West. We're not economists. So, you know, what are we, who are we to say?
But when you go there and physically see store shelves stocked with food, and I asked him, I talked about the malls and like the crowds and that sort of thing, it's just really, really amazing to see that. And one other thing I was going to say, and I can't remember. Oh, someone was saying in the chat, I just saw someone just said, you said it was over 6 months ago, Scott. And the point that I think he's been making and Colonel McGregor have been making is that it is over. Like, now all that's left is you're going to take 60,000 people, 60,000 Ukrainians, and you're just going to throw them into a meat grinder and they're going to be killed. That's what's going to happen. It is over. Like, it's all over. You heard Scott say it. It's all over, but the fighting. And you've heard that term time and time again. It's all over, but the fighting.
Yeah, it does seem like the boundary lines are drawn at this point. And this is where Russia intends to stay. And now we'll see, right? Because many people are saying, look, they were only coming in to surround the Donbas, the areas that were asking them for help.
Right.
They've done it. They're going to stay there. And, you know, this narrative that Putin's going to keep pushing towards Poland, going to take over Poland next and continue going west. Well, we'll see. Right? Now we'll see.
Right. We will indeed. Well, we've got more news to get to here on your Wednesday. It's a Wednesday night. Free speech might actually still be alive because, well, we'll tell you about what happened at Oxford.
In some places. That's right. We're going to talk about the Kathleen Stock event that went on this week, which, you know, a bunch of college students just whined and moaned and screamed and cried. They're like toddlers. They're literally like adult toddlers. And we're going to show you some of that as well.
Kit Clarenberg also joining us from the Gray Zone. He was detained by UK police on his return trip back to the island. Unbelievable, being interrogated and detained by police for his journalism for 5 hours. Unbelievable that this is happening in this modern day and age. So we're going to get to all of that. Plus, Tom Wheelwright's going to be joining us to talk about the economy and the decline of the U.S. dollar. He'll be coming up here shortly. But first, you don't need me to tell you, but that the U.S. dollar is in real trouble, in absolute free fall. The buying power of the U.S. dollar is declining. And that means that now is a really important time for you to be thinking about where to put some of your money. So, you know, we're not financial advisors, but I will tell you that Natalie and I are big advocates of buying precious metals. And when we do, we get our, we definitely buy gold coins and silver coins, because right now we are facing a gold and silver boom that could see prices of gold and silver hitting all-time highs. Well, I think Bank of America just came out with a target for the 1 ounce of gold about 3 weeks ago. Their target for this year is $2,500 an ounce for an ounce of gold. It's at about $1,900 right now, nearly $2,000. Unbelievable. Our friends at Lear Capital can actually help you get set up with precious metals. So if, let's say, you had $1,000 in savings and it's in a U.S. dollar savings account, that means that account is losing about 5% a year. Is it 5 to 6% a year in inflation?
It depends on the year, I suppose.
But yeah, so, well, it's normally be losing about 3%, right? So right now, because we're in such an inflationary period, that U.S. dollar that you have in a savings account continues to lose buying power every day that it's in there. So what Natalie and I have done have converted that to gold and silver, which has sustained for 4,000 years, has sustained its value and is going up and is a hedge against inflation. So even if you only put a little bit of your savings into precious metals, it's something to think about. It's something to consider. And I would just book a call with the guys from Lear Capital and just talk to them. Get a free gold kit, silver kit, talk it over with your family, have long discussions about it, see if it's a fit for you. Their 800 number is here on your screen, 1-800-613-3557. So write this number down and call them and just talk to one of their gold advisors, 1-800-613-3557, or go to learredacted.com. That's the website you can go to as well, learredacted.com. Get their precious metals investors guide. And they're giving up to $15,000 right now in free bonus metals with a qualified purchase. So check them out. Again, 800-613-3557. Check out our friends from Lear Capital.
All right. Well, yesterday at Oxford, a woman was allowed to speak despite hundreds of whiny baby college students protesting her right to speak. The woman in question is Professor Kathleen Stock. She is a lesbian professor of philosophy. The thing that she has said that made so many enemies, and she said this in 2018, and that made her trans right activist enemy number one, is this: trans women are biological males. That's what she said. That's what they do not want to hear. Now, in the year 2023, you are still not supposed to say that. So she was absolutely witch hunted when she was invited to speak at Oxford. And TRAs, trans rights activists, screamed throughout her talk. One leading up to the talk was successful at delaying the talk because this woman here glued herself to the floor, taking a page out of the Greenpeace activists. Glued her hand to the floor where she was supposed to speak there. I'm going to talk more about this girl later. But literally, like, you know, throwing yourself on the floor is what toddlers do, is what children do when they don't get their way, is they throw themselves on the floor, right? Yeah. Because they feel so powerless. This is not something that should be happening in academia. There should be speech, rebuttals. Go ahead.
Speaking of rebuttals, so this person glued their hands to the floor right by the podium where she was going to speak.
Yeah.
Right? So if that were me, I would have, no, you can stay right there. And I would have literally put my ass right in his face.
It's a girl, I think.
For the whole speech, I would just would have stood there right by the podium as a rebuttal.
But the thing is,
my ass in that person's
that
face.
They're going to scream.
They can scream.
They're going to scream the whole time. And we will see later that they do.
Yeah.
The thing is, now I've told you that Kathleen Stock is famous for asserting that you cannot become a woman if you are not born one. But she didn't even speak about gender at all. She was there to speak about free speech and the value of being offended, because at the heart of her haters is the idea that she should not even be allowed to say something that causes offense. Her speech was quite short. It was less than 10 minutes. And I want to show you two clips that I think that we as a society should want to contemplate. And I let this one go a little bit because you can see that some guy wants to like really prove his point and shout her down. And as he's speaking, there's a bunch of screaming. You can hear all kinds of ambient noise from the people who are, I mean, they brought noisemakers. It's the sort of, you know, normal trans right activist playbook is bring noisemakers, bring bullhorns, bring whatever you can do to drown out this so offensive message. Listen to what she says.
Every satirical joke that's ever been made has offended someone if it's been effective, because the whole point of satire is to mock irreverently that which people treat reverently. And it's also a paradoxical feature of offence that once some group is massively offended by X, then another group will be massively offended by them being offended. So the whole thing's going to get recursive quite quickly. And all this points to the fact that offence is cheap. It's a very cheap emotion. It's based on uncomfortable feelings in your body. You feel outraged. I'm feeling some of it right now. You know, it comes quick. It's subcortical. You can't even control it, as has been mentioned already. So why would we ever try to control that which humanly is uncontrollable, which is the feelings of offence when you hear things that... Yes.
What is she asking?
It's a man asking about being offended. I don't really know what he's asking, but the point is you can hear from behind him all of the protests.
You hear drums beating. And...
Yeah. And she just kind of keeps her calm and listens. Okay, that's good. We don't need to hear anymore of that, because now you can hear that she's speaking and you can hear she's kind of rattled because there's just so much distraction. But here is her main argument about a society that wants to avoid being offended so vehemently and what that will do to us. This is her whole point about restricting the whole idea of offense.
As I've already indicated, I think that it's a positive value to have a right to offend, and that is not offense is good, that is the right to offend is good, because every single moral improvement towards a just society has involved massive amounts of offense. And if we restrict offense, we effectively constrain the ways in which society can get more progressive, can get more just, and so on. And the final reason I want to commend this motion to you is that your generation, if most of you are undergraduates here, or certainly younger than me, is terrified of causing offense. You may not admit this. It's sort of even a taboo to admit that you're terrified of causing offense, because of course you're not. You're very moral people and you'd say what you think. But I don't think that's true. I think social media has made everybody very frightened of causing offense, of saying the right thing or the wrong thing. And that as you know, is a problem. And I'm sure you know that because I'm sure you sometimes have rebellious thoughts that you think would offend people if you could say them, but you still think you would quite like to be able to say them. And that's a free society, a healthy society, one in which we could air these things, we could be resilient enough to take very, very strong criticism, and we'd survive.
Okay, well, I think that she's demonstrating that resilience because she is taking very strong criticism, and she is persevering. The TRA's argument is that they cannot survive her offensive words, and they link offense to danger without statistically backing it up. And they argue that they should not even be subjected to distress at all, actually. So back to the woman who glued herself to the floor. She has already shown that she feels this way. You may have seen, this is the same person named Riz, I think is her first name, who had a debate with Piers Morgan recently, and that went viral. She also recently had an altercation with a gender critical person named Billboard Chris, who tends to get a lot of play in this gender critical space. He's a Canadian man who walks around with billboards like this. I actually quite like Billboard Chris's message. Do you have his billboard? Just the image, the still image? Yes, that one. What Billboard Chris has to say is that there are two biological sexes and zero genders.
And his billboard says, children cannot consent to puberty blockers. Stop the child abuse.
Yes. So he sort of uses these Christian fundamentalist tactics to, you know, gain your attention about gender critical. And I like this idea of meaning there's no way to express your gender. You are your biological sex. How you express yourself doesn't matter, masculine or feminine, but biology is immutable. I really like that take on it. But recently he was walking around in England with this billboard, and he came across this same activist who glued herself to the floor, and she went to the cops because of Billboard Chris. And watch how this turns out.
No, you're not allowed to obstruct.
Alarm and distress to anyone by blocking their right of way.
Are you seeing that? Because I'm pretty harassed, alarmed, and distressed right now.
So she says she's distressed right now?
Yeah. So I'll just give you that context again. He has a sign that says something like no puberty blockers, right? And she's like, you know,
she's like, I can't
trying
even look
to make
at it
sure that other people
I'm
can't
so
see
distressed.
It.
I'm so distressed. I
no,
can't.
Well, she's blocking him.
Oh, she's blocking him.
She's blocking the billboard.
Okay.
And the police says, you can't do that. You can't just go up and block someone's body like that. And he says, you can't cause distress to this man by like blocking his body. And she's like, what? Because I'm so distressed right now. Look at what I'm looking at and my distress. I think that this is actually a really good way that we should think about the idea of anti-fragility that these young people are promoting for themselves is that I cannot be expected to become stronger in the face of adversity. I am a delicate flower and I will therefore wither. You cannot subject me to hard concepts and thoughts and offense. Can we just play that one more time? Because as she points out her like, but look at me, look at my offense. I'm so distressed. That's why you should be protecting me. I feel like her reaction is so poignant.
No, you're not allowed to obstruct.
Alarm and distress to anyone by blocking their right of way.
Are you seeing that? Because I'm pretty harassed, alarmed, and distressed right now.
Okay. Me, look at me. I'm
it's
too fragile for this,
it's
right? I need you to realize that I have the right to not be offended. That's her argument, right? Against Kathleen Stock. Well, look at what some of these protesters just in the run-up to Kathleen Stock's speech today had to say about Kathleen Stock herself and why she shouldn't be able to offend them.
It's the fact that the union has given her a platform simply because they knew it would be controversial.
The Oxford Union to have her as the headline name without any experts coming to counter her arguments, I think is really dangerous because it's just going to be giving a lot of essentially fake news to people.
Trans students are being made to attend the union and fight for their own rights if they want to challenge her. There's no guarantee that the union committee will ask her questions that are representative of us.
Well, Professor Stock arrived very cloak and dagger for this event this evening via a back entrance. Security clearly a concern. She rejects that her views are hate speech, and she said that controversial and difficult views need to be tested in the public sphere. And that's a view that has been echoed by the Prime Minister as well, who supported this event taking place tonight.
You guys, In the year 2023, you need security if you say that a biological male cannot be a woman. You have to walk into an event with security in the... what is this world? And now it's funny because as she was walking in, I thought, oh my God, she's so brave. Like, look at her with this, you know, she seems so, and now she's sort of been memed by people who are gender critical. Can you show the image on your screen? You know, this sort of like walking bravely in the face of adversity to just only define something which we innately know as a species is now takes this kind of security and bravery.
To be a woman, an adult human female.
Yes.
That requires security.
Requires security to say that. You know, and what are they asking for? You know, these people who spoke on camera, they wanted an expert to counter her. I'm sorry, my accent's terrible. You know, this
expert to counter what she's saying.
But again, she's not speaking about gender. What she's speaking about is offense. So they wanted an expert to argue for this cult of safetyism.
Right. Idea that we've got to protect.
Speech is hurting you. Yeah, right.
That we've got to protect these fragile little delicate flowers.
Is anybody preventing them from inviting this mystery offense person? Like, did the university say you can't bring in a speaker?
No.
Yeah.
Like they need it to be at the exact same time. It needs to be point counterpoint in real like real time. That's the only way it's acceptable. Because they'll forget what they said before. That's just madness.
Yeah. No. And there are plenty of academics who will argue for this cult of safetyism. You're right. I can name about five right now if I'm really thinking about it. But I want to just give you this background about Kathleen Stock, because there's part of me that knows the history of this gender critical movement. And she's been at the heart of it for a really long time, even though other people like J.K. Rowling or Helen Joyce and Abigail Schreier have become a little bit more known for it, but it was always her at the center of it. And so now I think it's interesting that we're noticing that because she is an academic who has been so harassed that she quit her job at the University of Sussex recently because the university could no longer guarantee her safety. She also is the person that started the J.K. Rowling debate, and I just want to give you that background quickly. In 2018, Kathleen Stock wrote an article against the gender ID laws, and Maya Forstater, who worked at a think tank called Center for Global Development at the time, tweeted about a debate based on Kathleen Stock's ideas that sex is immutable. She was fired for that from her job. And this is the tweet that really got J.K. Rowling to jump into this world, where she said, dress however you please, call yourself what you like, sleep with any consenting adult who will have you, live your best life in peace and security, but force women out of their jobs for stating that sex is real. I stand with Maya. This is not a drill. This is the thing, you guys. This is the thing that got J.K. Rowling the label of TERF numeral uno.
People in the chat were asking, what is a TERF?
Trans exclusionary radical female.
AKA a woman.
No, it's a woman who wants to assert that we have a unique experience as biological women that men cannot self-select into.
So if you, a woman saying that only biological women can have a period.
Yes.
That makes you a TERF.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Or if I say, you know, yes, menstruation is an important part of womanhood. That makes me a TERF.
Breastfeeding.
Or even the women who wore those, you know, pea hats to the Trump rally.
You know,
those women were called TERFs because it made trans-identified males feel bad because they don't have peas.
Oh, yeah, because they were wearing vagina hats.
They were shaped as the P word. They called them the P hats.
And that was excluding the men who want to dress up as women.
Yes. And in fact, the knitting pattern that went around in advance of the women's rallies was called, we're going to knit the P hat. And they wore, you know, those. Mm-hmm. And that was trans exclusionary. Okay. So again, after this tweet, let's just circle back around. They called for J.K. Rowling's head on a platter. And it's worth noting that Maya Forstater has since won her case for wrongful termination, but only after an appeal, because the original court ruling was that her belief that sex is real was not a protected belief. The first judge ruled that her belief that sex was not worthy of respect in a democratic society. Literally, because she said biology is real, the judge ruled that that is not a belief worthy of respect. in our society. During the first trial, she was asked these questions. How did you come upon your novel belief that sex in humans is immutable? On what basis do you think male people cannot be female? Can you name a philosopher that agrees with you? That literally, she was asked these questions at trial. Where did she get this novel idea that sex is immutable? It was a clown show. She has since appealed and won. And so, again, this is why Kathleen Stock is so offensive, because she is one of the OGs, which I really like this sort of like gangster look of hers now, walking in like, yeah, I said that. A woman's a woman. I'm an original gangster here. This is why they feel better if she's silenced, alone, deplatformed, and dehumanized. But she spoke anyway, and I think that that's really something. She's not the only one, though. This week in Israel, the same thing happened to Abigail Schreier. Her book, Irreversible Damage, was published in Israel, but two publishers refused to carry it because her book makes the case that there is a social contagion to gender dysphoria and that medicalizing young bodies causes irreversible damage. Her speech that she gave was covered by the media like this. They called her like American ideology and anti-trans. They talked about how people just don't want to hear it. Two venues were pressured by pride groups to cancel her talk, even though hundreds of people had already paid for tickets. And the event had to be moved to a smaller suburban location. And here's how she put it. Like, even despite all of that, attendees had to walk through a throng of hundreds of enraged protesters screaming, blaring horns, and banging drums. Attendees knew that there might be disruption inside. And there was one protester who rushed the stage and had to be wrestled to the ground by audience members, something anyone who bought a ticket knew might happen. And still, it was standing room only. So the leftist media declares that only a few attended, but she said it was packed. And it's just, this is a technique totalitarians, she says, have always used to make their opponents feel small and marginalized. And it's an optical illusion because there are people who want to hear that their sexed experiences of their bodies matter. So that's your update on that one.
Unbelievable. Well, good for her for being able to speak. And I have to say, you know, we've been incredibly critical of Rishi Sunak.
Yeah.
Here on this channel. And we always call it like we see it, and we call it fair. He stood up and said she should be able to speak. And yes, he came out in her defense and said, absolutely, she should be able to speak. So,
yeah, he admonished Oxford to keep this on the books. And it, in fact, did happen. And Oxford actually was very vocal about the fact that, like, we think this should happen. We believe in free speech. And again, she was not even asked to speak about gender. Yeah. I don't know if these people actually had any, if they knew that she wasn't even there to speak about gender. They just don't want her to speak about anything.
Yeah.
So.
All right. Let us know your thoughts.
Just real quick. I was going to say, like, the idea of, you know, people should have the right to say whatever they want. Nobody has an obligation to listen. So the obligation is on you. If you don't want to hear what they have to say, then don't.
Right.
But you're trying to cut it off at the source is just ridiculous.
It's childish.
Yeah. If you've got a closed mind and you only watch things that affirm your world beliefs, like you're one of those like Fox News drones that only like flips on Fox News and keeps it on 24 hours a day, and you just regurgitate what Sean Hannity says, then good on you. Like, I don't want to hang out with you.
Yeah.
You
know? But you can not watch NBC then if that's what you want to do. Right.
You can't flip around and get a worldview. See, like, how is CNN spinning this story? How are these other things, you know, and just shut it all down and stand in front of people and impede their, their bodies.
I'm reading a book right now that I really disagree with. It's making me super uncomfortable. It's the type of book that, like, I don't know, but I keep with it because I'm like, is there something here for me? Is there something I can understand? Right. And I'm not so upset about it that I think this person should be deplatformed or silenced or alone or put in a basement. Right. And so I don't understand this baby cult of safetyism. I don't think it serves. I think we should want young people to be much more resilient than that.
And have conversations and debates. Right. So that's what this show is all about. We hope that we at least open your mind to these different viewpoints, that we don't have one viewpoint and we're all like drones and follow one way or the highway. We want you to be challenged every night on this show. We want you to be uncomfortable every night on this show, because that's the only way you grow. You only grow through discomfort. So all of this like fragility, we're like going to protect these little snowflakes from ever having to experience any discomfort in their lives, is going to raise an entire generation of feeble, fragile failures. Feeble, fragile.
That was a nice alliteration.
Feeble, fragile failures. I'm going to put that on a shirt. But all of our rebels here are not feeble, fragile failures. In fact, thanks to the team over the weekend, I don't know if you guys can see that. I guess you can. It's bright in here, but
yeah, they can see it.
So we have our goal. We're almost about to hit 2 million subscribers to Redacted. So right here is our Redacted Rebel goal.
Thank you, Tim Crowley.
Tim Crowley just became a Redacted Rebel. He just became a subscriber. It's free. You can just subscribe.
No, he became a Rebel Plus.
That's oh, he a became member. A Rebel Plus. Oh, he became a member. Whoa, Tim, yeah. Thank you for becoming a member. You can actually become a member as well. If you become a member, boom, your name gets up there even bigger as a Redacted Rebel. So right now we're at 1.935 million subscribers here to Redacted. Take that, CNN. Shove it up your, you know what. I love that we have more viewers than CNN.
So everybody call out to your 70,000 friends and tell them to join.
Yes,
and they'll
please.
Get their name up there.
Yes, please yeah. subscribe. That's all you need to do is subscribe.
Thank you, Farouk.
And also we have a Redacted community. I should mention, as Tim Crowley just found out, he became a member. You can become a VIP member today. All you need to do is go to redacted.inc. And right there on the right side of your screen, you see that? See that? It's the big join button. And if you're on Rumble right now, click that big red join button right there. And it's very easy to do on Rumble. YouTube doesn't make it so easy, but you have to go to redacted.inc to join our Redacted Rebellion. And for the price of a cup of coffee once a month, you can support independent journalism and what we do here. We're not bought and paid for by billionaires. We don't take any of Rupert Murdoch's money. None of that stuff. We are free and independent, and we are supported by you. And if you want to support independent journalism, like our next guest here on the show, being able to bring voices of independent journalists, that's what we try to do here. So redacted.inc is the place to go, and you can become a member if you'd like. If not, you can still, you know, just subscribe and follow, and it's totally free. But if you want to take that extra step, we have some live streams coming up that we're going to be doing exclusively to our community. If you're a Redacted Rebel, we'll be hanging out with you exclusively, and some content that only Redacted Rebels get access to. So again, redacted.inc. Well, it is a dangerous time to be an excellent journalist, a journalist that's not bought and sold by billionaires supporting some narrative. And that is exactly why excellent journalists like Kit Clarenberg from The Gray Zone need our support more than ever. And last week, Kit Clarenberg was detained upon arriving at London's airport, at Luton Airport, by counterterrorism police, pulled him off the airplane, subjected him to a five-hour interrogation about his political views and his reporting for The Gray Zone, taking his electronic devices, among other things. And Kit Clarenberg joins us now to tell this story. Kit, welcome to the show.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So can you just tell us what happened?
Okay, well, I mean, the second that the plane touched down in Luton, which is one of the worst airports in the world, the pilot said over the tannoy, everyone have your passports ready because border control is just around the corner. In my naivety, I wondered whether the airport had been restructured since I was last there some time ago. As I got to the tarmac, there was a team of plainclothes officers waiting, checking everyone's passport. And the second that they read my name, they asked me to come with them, and I was taken to a back room. My digital devices were taken from me, my bank cards were taken from me. I had to provide my pins to get into my SIM cards, and indeed my tablet and my phone. I was subject to what's known as a digital strip search, where they can seize all of the data from your digital devices, including things which have been deleted. I think the UK is almost boastful of the fact that it's the one country in the world that can do this, as horrifying as that is. And yes, I was grilled for 5 hours. There was a lot of generalist interrogation about, you know, where I lived in Serbia, which is my, you know, adopted home country, you know, my address there, how much my rent was, you know, whether my energy bills were included in my rent, you know, all sorts of, you know, like really, you know, bizarrely probing questions. But then when they got into the real swing of things, when they started quizzing me about the gray zone, you know, I mentioned that I wrote for a number of websites, and they claimed, oh, you know, well, we would like to talk to you more about that. But no, the entire focus was the gray zone. They had obviously been keeping an eye on my output for the gray zone for some time. You know, at one point, after I mentioned I wrote for Mint Press News, one of the officers said, oh, I've never heard of Mint Press Zone. And yet, you know, by contrast, they had read my recent investigation into the CIA's recruitment of two 9/11 hijackers for gray zone. And that led into an extensive discussion about 9/11 conspiracy theories and what I thought about, you know, what my perspective was and what happened. And then there was a number of very specific questions. How is the gray zone funded? How are you paid? What are your bank account details of the bank that you receive funding from, your income from gray zone? Does the gray zone have any kind of relationship with the FSB, which is, you know, Russia's Federal Security Service? Does the gray zone have a formal agreement with the FSB to publish hacked documents? I mean, at one point I was kind of compelled to say, well, you know, some of the stuff that we've reported on, which seems to have, you know, landed me in here, there's no evidence that it, you know, that it was indeed hacked. And indeed, you know, I mean, even if it was, you know, in that context, as a journalist, it is incumbent upon you to make a judgment about the authenticity of material, and whether it's in the public interest. You know, in that we don't publish and never would, off-record briefings from anonymous intelligence officials, as, you know, a significant proportion of the Western media does almost every day. Right. We wouldn't do that. You know, in that context, the source is the material, not who or what may have given it to you. And this led into a protracted philosophical discussion about, you know, whether my work was in the public interest or whether it was just interesting to the public, and, you know, whether I was assisting Russia's, you know, war effort and all this. Yeah, you know, did I know anyone? Am I in contact with any Russians? Do I have Russian friends? It just went on and on and on. For 5 hours. And meanwhile, they were, it seems, in a very granular way, going over the contents of my digital devices and memory cards. I even unwittingly brought camera memory cards with me. These are, you know, pictures of architecture that I've taken when I've been on holiday over the years. Pity whoever drew the short straw and had to sit there going through photo after photo of, you know, like brutalist architecture of Lithuania or Spain. It's really quite extraordinary.
Did they give it back to you? Did they give your devices back to you?
Yeah, I mean, they held my tablet for a week subsequently, and I got it back, and it had tape over the cameras. I mean, quite what they've done with it. I mean, you know, I only use it for reading anyway. They took my phone. That's probably got some kind of spying software installed in it now. Lucky I don't have anything to hide. But I mean, still, these are things which play on your mind constantly, you know, in the wake of an experience like that. And they still have, you know, one of my memory cards. It's very old. It primarily has music on it. But yes, I mean, quite what they might find on there, is anyone's guess, really. It's really quite disturbing. I might add that, yes, that this was explicitly done under the auspices of Schedule 3 of a 2019 Terrorism Act. It's not been used very often. It's primarily been used to target activists. But I think this might be the very first time that they've used it to go after a journalist. And, like, you know, I mean, there's all, in the language and the paperwork that I've supplied with is all, you know, in the context of state threats, like, you know, that as if I personally or, you know, and or my reporting poses a threat to the security of Britain, which is, you know, it's really shocking. And I think that, yes, in this, you know, bearing in mind that Britain's leading the Western contribution to the proxy war and is doing all it can to try and pressure the US to go all in, you know, deploy boots on the ground, arm Ukraine to the teeth. In that context, Britain is effectively at war, you know, undeniably so. And then, you know, in that context, I mean, as happened in both world wars, you know, officially official, you know, direct censorship and the power of the state to criminalize free speech and imprison anyone possessed of, you know, alternative viewpoints to the, you know, to the mainstream, or indeed who is in possession of and willing to disseminate inconvenient truths from the perspective of power, you know, faces the very real risk of going to prison. You know, I'm still under effectively you're under investigation. While, as I mentioned, my memory, that memory card is being held on the basis that you know, the investigating officers feel that it may be relevant to criminal proceedings in future. Yeah, it's truly disturbing, and I'm extremely grateful for the, you know, the hundreds, if not thousands, of people who have, you know, have expressed solidarity with me and the Grey Zone, and have recognized the reality that this is, you know, an endorsement of the veracity of our reporting and also its significance.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, as the Gray Zone reports, as Max Blumenthal reported in a piece on the Gray Zone, because Clarenberg's reporting on Paul Mason specifically, among Clarenberg's most consequential exposés was his June 2022 report unmasking British journalist Paul Mason as a UK secretary, a security state collaborator, hell-bent on destroying the Gray Zone and other media outlets. Did that come up in your conversations with these investigators?
Not directly, but I mean, I do wonder whether the terror police, whose names I never learned, I learned their call signs. It was all very, very odd. I mean, I do wonder whether they and or Britain's security and intelligence services have been fed a large amount of completely ludicrous information kind of conspiracy theory rubbish about me in the Grey Zone by Paul Mason and people like Emma Bryant, his academic collaborator. Because, you know, some of the questions were, you know, I mean, do you have set requirements for how much work you do and, you know, what you report on for the Grey Zone? And then some of the leaked material that Max and myself reported on, there is an email in which Paul Mason said that he wanted to find out what our deliverables were to the, you know, to the Russian and Chinese spying agencies that obviously run us. I mean, it's completely farcical. But yes, I mean, there was some questioning which seemed to suggest that that was a key consideration of theirs. I mean, you know, I mean, that, again, that kind of rather tends to confirm our characterization of Paul Mason as a British intelligence asset. I mean, yeah, I think as well that there was, you know, there was an as I mentioned, there was an extended discussion about whether things are, you know, whether my reporting was public interest or just simply interesting to the public. You know, the obvious implication being that I had no right to publish this information, even if it was factually true. And I think that, in a sense, it does cut to the, in a roundabout way, it cuts to the core of why the British state wants to shut me and indeed Grey Zone up, is that we expose things. Not only that, you know, the security and intelligence services want to bury or suppress or ignore, but also, you know, on issues that governments are, you know, doing their absolute best to, you know, to bury. So, you know, recently we published an investigation into how two returning neo-fascist fighters who were active in Ukraine and had ties to a variety of, you know, far right groups in the country were jailed upon their return to Paris from Kiev, because they had all manner of weaponry and ammunition in their possession, which was completely illegal. You know, why did they have this? I wonder. You know, cut back to the end of last year, my friend and colleague Alex Rubenstein reported on how a neo-Nazi terror cell who'd been planning mass shootings and bombings of, you know, civilian targets in Italy ended up in jail. They had deep direct links to Azov Battalion, you know, the far right a military grouping in Ukraine, but also right sector and Centuria. These are openly neo-Nazi groups that have received extensive funding and training at elite British and American and Canadian military facilities. Now, the British American governments in recent years have done much to talk up the threat of, you know, domestic right-wing extremism, which seems to, you know, effectively be a means by which to criminalize and malign the right wing, or indeed, you know, all alternative kind of anti-establishment viewpoints. And yet, when these things happen, As they seem to be happening on an almost monthly basis. You know, Biden and Sunak are completely silent. You know, in the US at the start of this year, there was a plot busted by two members of a group called Atom Waffen. They were planning to blow up, damage the electricity supply of Baltimore, which is, you know, a majority black city in the US. And they explicitly did this to deprive the city's residents of heat and light at a time when, you know, that's kind of almost life-threatening. The lack of either. This passed without mention.
Ignored.
And Atom Waffen have extensive ties to Azov. Their operatives have been trained at Azov camps in Ukraine. And it's like, so on the one hand, we have this kind of constant drum beating of this extremely dangerous domestic right-wing terror threat. And yet when it actually happens, they don't want to know about it. Right. There was a recent report by Britain's intelligence and British Parliament's Intelligence and Security Committee that said that lamented the fact that there is no mechanism in place to monitor, keep an eye on returning fascists from Ukraine. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And it is, you know, it's the people who will suffer will be the general public.
Right.
That is a deeply inconvenient and grave truth. And we are almost unique in the English language media for having reported on it.
Yeah, what the Grezo does, of course, is unparalleled. And you're right about that, you know, because the United States government is more concerned with watching school board meetings right now and tracking the likes of people who go to school board meetings rather than going after people like this. Kit, where did they leave it with you? So this investigation is just going to continue. They're going to hold some of your memory cards. They're going to stay in contact with you and let you know what? What did they tell you after they let you go after 5 hours?
Well, I mean, as I say, yes, they are retaining my property on the basis that it might be used in criminal proceedings. So, I mean, that's, you know, hanging over me. I'm still under investigation, although I was free to leave the UK, which I'm, you know, thank God I did. I'm so glad to be off that godforsaken island. I think that they may have, you know, underestimated the level of, you know, public outcry that this would create. I've had a large number of people on Twitter today, including people with whom I couldn't disagree more politically and have had, you know, barbed words with in the past, who were making a stink about this, expressing shock and outrage that this could possibly happen, and making the very obvious point that, you know, you might not agree with, you know, what I write, but, you know, the mere fact that my ability to do so is under threat is a significant concern. There's no end in sight with this proxy war. I strongly suspect that irrespective of its outcome, you know, when and what happens, it's going to be an extremely dangerous environment for independent journalists. Not least because, you know, any objective investigation or analysis of the proxy war will be that this is all round a complete disaster for everyone involved, and the individuals and organisations which have been involved ramping up, based in London and Washington, have had absolutely no consideration for the blowback or the damaging impact this is going to have on average people. It's going to stay with us for a very long time.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to be any end in sight. Now, we're going to continue to fund this, and it'll continue for years to come. And we're hearing that right out of the mouths, basically, of Washington. Kit, we're glad that you're safe. We're glad that you're able to talk with us, we wanted to have you on to tell this story and hopefully as a wake-up call for what's happening to journalists out there. Kit Clarenberg from The Gray Zone, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And I encourage all of you to go to thegrayzone.com and read this piece on Kit Clarenberg and the detainment there that Max Blumenthal wrote. Just unbelievable. Just unbelievable to see what's happening with journalists. I see people here in the comments saying Gonzalo Lira. Yes, in Ukraine, of course. And what happened there. And Julian Assange.
Yeah.
We've featured a number of journalists, Spanish journalists, German journalists who've been given government papers and told that they're breaking the law for telling the truth about what's happening in Ukraine.
Yeah, it's terrifying.
It's unbelievable.
Well, there's also that, I believe she was Dutch or Danish. I can't remember, maybe Danish, but there was a reporter that was just like, she all she did was literally like mention that like a side that wasn't just completely like Ukraine is absolutely great. And Ukraine revoked her press yeah. pass, and the Danish prime minister got involved in that.
They showed her to the border.
The details. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's unbelievable. So independent journalists need our support more than ever. So the Gray Zone, and it's G-R-A-Y, by the way, Gray Zone.
Whenever I quote them in the newsletter, I can't remember.
No, I always have to fix it in the newsletter. It's G-R-A. It's like, you know, the gray zone, G-R-A-Y. Anyway, we're glad that Kit is back in Serbia and off of out of UK right now. So anyway, we've got more news to get to here. Tom Wheelwright, I sat down with Tom Wheelwright a short time ago. Actually, he was in studio yesterday. And we had a great conversation, so we're going to play that interview for you in a moment. He's one of the smartest financial tax accountants that we know. He's brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. And
he's willing to talk about the politicization of the IRS.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Hunter Biden story.
I was like, ooh, can we ask him about Hunter Biden? And he was willing to talk about it.
Being pulled off of the Hunter Biden case, the IRS agents, the whistleblowers who came forward being pulled off of that case. He has a lot of thoughts about that as well, as well as the declining U.S. dollar. So, we don't want you to miss that. But first, we have a store. So if you'd like to support independent journalism, you'd like to grab a hoodie, you'd like to grab a mug, you'd like to grab a hat. One of my hats there. I wear my redacted hat every day while I take Grover on a nice long walk. That's my dog, not my son. And we go through the forest, and I wear my redacted hat. We've got our redacted mugs and hoodies and all of that. They're really comfortable, and we don't mark up the prices at all. We try to keep them very, very, like, right at cost to support the show, but also to keep them as cheap as possible. So that gray hat, that's my favorite one right there, the one right coming up on the screen, and the water bottles and everything else. So go to redactedstore.com. There's imitators out there. People have been making a redacted store on Facebook and other stuff. No, we don't have a Facebook store. Our store, the real one, is redactedstore.com. Go to redactedstore.com. David Crawford in our chat says he wants redacted action figures. I love that idea. Maybe coming soon, perhaps, to redactedstore.com. Well, we are up against a deadline, the debt ceiling deadline, just a few days away. But is there a bigger story at play? How can the United States government sustain this level of deficit living? With us is one of the smartest minds that I know in the financial world. The brilliant Tom Wheelwright is not only my personal accountant, he is one of the smartest tax accountants in the world. And he is the owner of the Wealthability Network and the host of the Wealthability podcast. Natalie and I speak about it often here on the show. And we're so thrilled to have Mr. Tom Wheelwright in studio, in the flesh. So great to see you.
It is awesome to be here, Clayton. Just phenomenal.
It's really, really a treat. It's our treat. So really excited to be able to talk with you about a number of topics. But first, we wanted to talk to you about the debt ceiling. Of course, that's the thing that's on everyone's mind, which is the expansion of the ceiling. We're going to be able to print more money. And they're arguing that, of course, that they're actually going to lower spending. But that's not really going to happen at all, lowering spending. They're pretending that that's going to happen. So what does this mean for the future of the economy and the U.S. dollar, do you think?
Well, you know, obviously, the more money you put in the economy, you know, inflation is just more money chasing fewer goods. And, you know, supply chain comes back on, we get more supply up and running. As long as they balance, it's okay. But what happens is that if the government keeps putting money into the economy and there's not a lot more production in the economy, that's when you have inflation.
Right. So not enough production. We have 1 million manufacturing jobs that are open right now in the United States. 1 million.
Yeah. The big issue right now is that we have a lot of people not working.
Right.
That are capable of working. And we need them to work. So we actually have such a shortage of manpower, woman power, people power, that we don't have enough workers for the jobs that are open. And so it's very hard to increase production. Of course, hopefully technology will help solve some of that, particularly with the AI coming online. But it won't solve it quickly. So it will take some time. And during that time, that's when you see the inflation.
So it seems like lawmakers have a deal. But of course, it's not coming with any changes in behavior, as you mentioned. So we're going to continue to run up against this. So if we expand this for two more years, we go two more years and then we're back to the same thing. And then we're, what, $40 trillion in national debt. It doesn't seem like this is sustainable at all. I mean, you look at the numbers, how is the government pulling this kind of revenue to cover these debts?
Well, they're not. They're not actually. So it really depends on, the theory behind what I call magic money theory, mm-hmm. right? This monetary policy is that as long as you can print money, you're fine. If you can then tax people when the inflation gets too high. The problem that our government has is that they won't tax the right people. So taxing the rich actually reduces production because that's where the investment comes from.
But I thought, as Elizabeth Warren says all the time, if we got to tax the rich, we got to take these billionaires down. Like that's how we improve the economy.
Okay, so if you want to slow inflation,
right.
The people that are going to slow the inflation are the consumers. Those aren't the multimillionaires. They're not the consumers. The consumers are the middle class. Okay, that's who you would have to tax if you really wanted to slow down inflation. That's why the Fed is raising interest rates, because they feel like, well, then, okay, if your credit card debt is higher,
right.
It's at a higher interest rate. If your home mortgage is at a higher interest rate, you will tend to spend less money. So it's an indirect, it's really, inflation is a tax on the poor and the middle class,
is really
what it is.
Right. So the Fed seems to be moving inflation points based on sentiment. Is this actually working? Like what are they really moving these inflation points based on, do you think?
Here's the problem. Until they get the interest rate higher than the inflation rate, then it really doesn't work.
Right.
I mean, and they're not there yet.
Right.
So that's why I think there's a pretty good case for them increasing the interest rates again in June. Because I just think that they think that, well, they're worried about the economy, but the reality is they've caused this economic catastrophe. Right. They first of all, the government put too much money in. Both Republicans and the Democrats put way too much money into the economy. And then the Fed denied that there was actually any inflation, systemic inflation coming. And so they acted too late.
Right.
They just maintained those low interest rates too long. And so, now what we have is we have really systemic inflation, and the chances of it going out of control are actually pretty decent.
One of the things, of course, I'm most concerned about is our audience here, which is the consumers. And so they're seeing the price of everything going up, gasoline going up, eggs going up. We saw the egg crisis. So what does this do overall to consumers when you keep moving this goalpost like this?
Well, when you think about it, consumers only have a certain amount of money to spend, right? I mean, this is why this isn't a tax on the rich, because the rich they can spend as much money as they want. If gas goes to $10 a gallon, that's not going to affect a wealthy person's driving behavior. But if gas at $5 a gallon for gas, that means that middle-class family has to allocate money differently.
Right.
So they either have to change behavior, they have to start taking public transportation, or they have to work from home, or they have to do things differently because they only have a limited amount of funds, or they have to promote inflation, which is, I need a raise. And that just drives inflation up even more.
You talk to a lot of experts on your show on the Wealthability podcast, and plus your clients too. You deal with a lot of really smart people and a lot of really wealthy people. We've heard Peter Schiff talking about that we are in a recession, and he thinks that we are in a great financial crisis. The media is totally ignoring the story. They're not calling it a financial crisis at all. They're totally ignoring this, and he thinks we actually could be worse than the Great Depression. First of all, do you think the media is doing a disservice? And also, do you think we are in a Great Depression or in a great recession?
Well, it depends on what you call depression. So if a depression means we're growing less all the time, it's not that we're actually in a depression. In other words, we're not losing money. In other words, there's not deflation, but rather that there's just not as much growth. Then there's no question we've been actually in a recession for quite a while, because our growth has been much lower than the target for several years now.
Right.
So this is not a new thing. This is something that's been going on. Jim Rickards calls it the new Great Depression, right?
Right.
And but if you look at it as purely, well, we have to actually have depressed prices, we're certainly not there yet. So I, you know, I don't think it's a depression in the classic form,
right?
But certainly there's an argument for calling it that.
I'd be remiss if, having you in the studio, I didn't get to ask you an IRS question and a Hunter Biden question. Now, you used to work in the Treasury.
No, I worked for Ernst & Young, and I was in the National Tax Office of Ernst & Young, which was in Washington, D.C.
In Washington,
so I had good friends in the Treasury Department, and, you know, I testified on regulations and other things before the IRS and Treasury.
So, glad I cleared that up. For some reason, I had a thought of memory of you, but you had a close relationship. You knew a lot of those guys. So given the Hunter Biden IRS situation, where whistleblowers come forward on the IRS side and they're pulled off of this investigation, which has been going on for years, what do you make of this? Number of these guys come forward and say, we've been pulled off, and is it political? Is there something else at play here?
Sounds a lot like Lois Lerner, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
It just does. It has the same feel to it, but the IRS has had that feel to me since the last commissioner. He was a tax attorney, the previous commissioner, and we were all very hopeful, and he like turned really fast. And we thought that he would, and what he did was he just said, well, all the people he had represented before, he just said, well, they're criminals. So the people he was representing now are criminals.
Wow.
And so that's why he started going after people, even though they were following the law, whether it be a conservation easement or captive insurance or some of these other things. They're generous provisions in the law. There's no question. They're generous provisions. But they're in the law.
Right.
I mean, they're not loopholes.
Right.
These are in the law. And when you go after people for doing things that are in the law, and then you take people off an investigation that looks to be outside the law, then you have to wonder, is there political motivation? I mean, remember, Joe Biden was in the White House during the Lois Lerner days. So.
Of course. Yeah. Yeah, Lois Lerner, of course, who oversaw what the Cincinnati targeting of conservative groups in the IRS.
Right, anybody that had Patriot in the name of their 501c4,
right?
They were slow rolled.
Unbelievable. Yeah. I know you avoid getting into, you know, overly political in your Wealth Ability podcast, but we have seen the IRS become even more and more political, and then we hear this announcement about we're adding 80,000. IRS agents, and one of the caveats to that employment is that they will be armed, IRS agents.
No. So let's be clear, okay? There are IRS agents and there are IRS auditors. IRS agents have been around ever since the beginning of the IRS. They are federal law enforcement officers. There's about 2,500 of them, and they're going to raise that to maybe 3,000.
Okay.
And they are the ones who carry guns.
They're the armed ones.
If you have an IRS agent come to your house, you did something really bad. I mean, like, you didn't pay over your employees' payroll taxes for months and months and years and years.
Wow.
So these are the people who come to repossess your car. They come to repossess your house. You've done something really bad if an IRS agent shows up. What they're talking about is hiring a lot more IRS auditors. And so what they're doing is it's really interesting. They're taking all of the current IRS auditors and moving into supervisory roles. So they're just immediately getting a promotion.
Mm.
And then they're bringing in young, brand new IRS auditors that will be green. I mean, they're really brand new. And then they're bringing a bunch of lawyers. They're bringing a bunch of IRS lawyers. And a lot of that money is going to go to lawyers. And the reason is because here's how this is going to happen, Clayton, is that they're going to do what I call a checklist audit. And they will come in with a checklist and say, okay, I need this, 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 this. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've handled a number of audits over the years, and, you know, they give you a information document request called an IDR, and it asks for pretty much the same things every time, right? Here's the typical thing. Well, they're going to come up with even more specific checklists. And if you don't meet that checklist, you're just going to be denied. Mm. Now, the concern is that they will not have enough experience. So they will not be able to make judgment calls. Without experience, you can't make judgment calls, right? You don't know how to make those judgment calls, or they won't have authority. And so what will likely happen is that you will just be denied. Well, then you'll say, well, then I'll go to the supervisor. Well, that's probably your best shot because the supervisor's got experience. Let's say the supervisor says no. Well, then you have to go to either appeals, which in many cases is a rubber stamp of the IRS, or you actually have to go to tax court, which can be like, I had an attorney tell me that to take a captive insurance case to tax court is going to run about $2 million.
Wow.
So what it means is you have an 800-pound gorilla who is able to sit on you, and you're going to have a lot of people, they already are now, that they're turning over their checkbooks because they can't afford to go to court. And the IRS just has basically an unlimited amount of funds. And when you give them another $80 billion, well, good news is this budget deal is taking away about $21 billion of that. And it's coming from enforcement. So that's good. It's not going to come from technology. It's not going to come from customer service. It looks like it's going to come from enforcement, which is good because $80 billion is probably too much. They need some.
Yeah.
Okay. They certainly need to upgrade their technology. For sure. And I would hope that they would spend most of that money in technology because that's where the best enforcement comes from anyway, right? They check your 1099 against their copy of the 1099. They send you a notice. That's easy. Right. That's the kind of enforcement we should have. We shouldn't have full-fledged IRS audits. We shouldn't need them because technology should be able to handle that.
Well, there we go. Thank you for clearing that up. So it's not 80,000 armed IRS agents showing up at people's houses. Well, of course, when you see the job postings and you see armed, you will be carrying a firearm.
Well, that was for the IRS agent. And,
right.
And that is a very limited position. There are very few of those.
They should have done a better job of explaining
this. They did a terrible job of that.
they need to hire somebody in their
very bad PR
department. Tom Wheelwright, great to see you. People should check out your podcast if they're interested in, the tagline of your podcast is?
The tagline podcast is way more money and way less tax.
Way more money, way less tax. And he teaches you how to actually do that and navigate this crazy tax code. I highly recommend it. One of the smartest people I know. Tom, great to have you here in studio.
Thanks, Clayton. Great to be here.
My pleasure. Oh, and we should remind you that we do have a daily newsletter. We would love for all of you to subscribe to the newsletter. Just go to redacted.inc where we cover the debt ceiling. Of course, we've been covering that just about every day as we look at what Congress is going to do there. So all you need to do is go to redacted.inc. It's not .com, it's .inc. And then just put in your email address and then you will receive a welcome email from me, from Clayton at redacted.inc. And you just need to make sure, go in your spam folder, probably go to your spam folder, might go to your junk folder, something like that. Then just you'll need to verify that you want to join the newsletter. And then just put us in your VIP list, move us over to your inbox. And then tomorrow morning, when we publish the newsletter, first thing, about 6:30, 7 a.m. Eastern time, you'll receive that newsletter and you can read it in about 5 or 10 minutes. And we cover like 4 or 5 big stories of the day with a little humor. We try to make you laugh a little bit. We try to make you smile. We try to start your day off on the right foot, giving you some really important information that the mainstream media ignores. And then you're on your day. You can read it in about 5 or 10 minutes. Anyway, go to redacted.inc, sign up for the free newsletter, totally free. And you'll get the newsletter first thing tomorrow morning. And I just want to thank all of you. Thank Tom again for joining us here in the studio. Thank you to all of you who subscribe to the show and are a part of our Redacted community. Thank you for being a Redacted rebel. We really, really appreciate it. We'll be back here tomorrow at 4 p.m. Eastern time. Have a great night, everyone.